intercepted by Wamba. The jester, making up by agility for the want of strength, and little noticed by the men-at-arms who were busied in their more important object, hovered on the skirts of the fight and effectually checked the fatal career of the Blue Knight by hamstringing his horse with a stroke of his sword. Horse and man went to the ground. Yet the situation of the Knight of the Fetterlock continued very precarious as he was pressed close on all sides by men completely armed and began to be fatigued with the violent exertion necessary to defend himself on so many points at nearly the same moment when a grey goose shaft suddenly stretched on the earth one of the most formidable of his assailants and a band of yeomen broke forth from the glade headed by Locksley and the jovial friar, who, taking ready and effectual part in the fray, soon disposed of the assailants, all of whom lay on the spot dead or mortally wounded. The Black Knight thanked his deliverers with a dignity they had not observed in his former bearing, which hitherto seemed rather that of a blunt, bold soldier than of a person of exalted rank. "It concerns me much," he said, "even before I express my full gratitude to my ready friends, to discover, if I may, who have been my unprovoked enemies. Open the visor of that Blue Knight, Wamba, who seems the chief of these villains." The jester instantly made up to the leader of the assassins, who, bruised by his fall and entangled under the wounded steed, lay incapable either of flight or resistance.
"Come, valiant sir," said Wamba, "I must be your armourer as well as your equerry. I have dismounted you, and now I will unhelm you."
So saying, with no very gentle hand, he undid the helmet of the Blue Knight, which, rolling to a distance on the grass, displayed to the Knight of the Fetterlock grizzled locks and a countenance which he did not expect to have seen under such circumstances.
"Waldemar Fitzurse," he said in astonishment. "What could urge one of thy rank and seeming valour to so felon an undertaking?"
"Richard," said the captive knight, looking up to him, "thou knowest little of mankind, if thou knowest not to what ambition and revenge can lead every child of Adam."
"Revenge?" answered the Black Knight. "I never wronged thee. On me thou hast naught to avenge."
"My daughter, Richard, whose alliance thou didst scorn, was that no injury to a Norman whose blood is as noble as thine own?"
"Thy daughter," replied the Black Knight,
"a proper cause of enmity, and followed up to a bloody issue. Stand back, my masters, I would speak with him alone."
"And now, Waldemar Fitzurse, say me the truth. Confess who set thee on this traitorous deed."
"Thy father's son," answered Waldemar, "who in so doing did but avenge on thee thy disobedience to thy father."
Richard's eyes sparkled with indignation, but his better nature overcame it. He pressed his hand against his brow and remained for an instant gazing on the face of the humbled baron, in whose features pride was contending with shame.
"Thou dost not ask thy life, Waldemar," said the king.
"He that is in the lion's clutch," answered Fitzurse, "knows it were needless."
"Take it then, unasked," said Richard. "The lion preys not on prostrate carcasses. Take thy life, but with this condition, that within 3 days thou leave England and go to hide thine infamy in thy Norman castle, and thou wilt never mention the name of John of Anjou as connected with thy felony. If thou art found on English ground after the space I have allotted thee, thou diest. Or if thou breathest aught that can attain the honour of my house, by my patron Saint George, not the altar itself shall be a sanctuary. I will hang thee out to feed the ravens from the very pinnacle of thine own castle.
Let this knight have a steed, Locksley, for I see your yeomen have caught those which were running loose, and let him depart unharmed."
"But that I judge I listen to a voice whose behests must not be disputed," answered the yeoman, "I would send a shaft after the skulking villain that should spare him the labour of a long journey."
"Thou bearest an English heart, Locksley," said the Black Knight, "and well dost judge thou art the more bound to obey my behest. I am Richard of England."
At these words, pronounced in a tone of majesty suited to the high rank and of no less distinguished character of Coeur de Lion, the yeomen at once kneeled down before him, and at the same time tendered their allegiance and implored pardon for their offences. "Rise, my friends," said Richard in a gracious tone, looking on them with a countenance in which his habitual good humour had already conquered the blaze of hasty resentment, and whose features retained no mark of the late desperate conflict, excepting the flush arising from exertion. "Arise," he said, "my friends. Your misdemeanours, whether in forest or field, have been atoned by the loyal services you rendered my distressed subjects before the walls of Torquilstone, and the rescue you have this day afforded to your sovereign. Arise, my liegemen, and be good subjects in future. And thou, brave Locksley, call me no longer Locksley, my liege, but know me under a name which I fear fame hath blown too widely not to have reached even your royal ears. I am Robin Hood of Sherwood Forest." "King of outlaws and prince of good fellows," said the king, "who hath not heard a name that has been borne as far as Palestine? But be assured, brave outlaw, that no deed done in our absence and in the turbulent times to which it hath given rise shall be remembered to thy disadvantage."
"True says the proverb," said Wamba, interposing his word, but with some abatement of his usual petulance. "When the cat is away, the mice will play."
"What, Wamba, art thou there?" said Richard. "I have been so long of hearing thy voice, I thought thou hadst taken the flight."
"Aye, the flight," said Wamba. "When do you ever find folly separated from valour? There lies the trophy of my sword, that good grey gelding, whom I heartily wish upon his legs again, conditioning his master lay hock there in his place. It is true I gave a little ground at first, for Motley does not brook lance heads as a steel doublet will, but if I fought not at sword's point, you will grant me that I sounded the onset."
"And to good purpose, honest Wamba," replied the king. "Thy good service shall not be forgotten."
"Confiteor, confiteor," exclaimed in a submissive tone a voice near the king's side. "My Latin will carry no farther, but I confess my deadly treason, and pray leave to have absolution before I am led to execution."
Richard looked around and beheld the jovial friar on his knees, telling his rosary, while his quarter-staff, which had not been idle during the skirmish, lay on the grass beside him. His countenance was gathered so as he might best express the most profound contrition, his eyes being turned up, and the corners of his mouth drawn down, as Wamba expressed it, like the tassels at the mouth of a purse. Yet this demure affectation of extreme penitence was whimsically belied by a ludicrous meaning which lurked in his huge features, and seemed to pronounce his fear and repentance alike hypocritical.
"For what art thou cast down, mad priest?" said Richard. "Art thou afraid thy diocesan should learn how truly thou dost serve Our Lady and Saint Dunstan? Dash, man, fear it not. Richard of England betrays no secrets that pass over the flagon."
"Nay, most gracious sovereign," answered the hermit,
well known to the curious in penny histories of Robin Hood by the name of Friar Tuck,
"it is not the crozier, I fear, but the sceptre. Alas, that my sacrilegious fist should ever have been applied to the ear of the Lord's anointed."
"Ha, ha," said Richard, "sits the wind there. In truth, I had forgotten the buffet, though mine ears sung after it for a whole day as if I had a psaltery in my head. But if the cuff was fairly given, I will be judged by the good men around if it was not as well repaid. Or if thou thinkest I still owe thee aught, and will stand forth for another counterbuff—"
"By no means," replied Friar Tuck. "I had mine own back, and with usury, may your majesty ever pay your debts as fully."
"If I could do so with cuffs," said the king, "my creditors should have little reason to complain of an empty exchequer."
"And yet," said the friar,
resuming his demure, hypocritical countenance,
I know not what penance I ought to perform for that most sacrilegious blow.
Speak no more of it, brother, said the king. After having stood so many cuffs from Paynim and Misbeliever, I were void of reason to quarrel with the buffet of a clerk so holy as he of Coppenhurst. Yet, mine honest friar, I think it would be best both for the church and thyself that I should procure a license to unfrock thee, and retain thee as a yeoman of our guard, serving in care of our person, as formerly upon the altar of St. Dunstan.
My liege, said the friar, I humbly crave your pardon, and you would readily grant my excuse, did you but know how the sin of laziness has beset me. St. Dunstan, may he be gracious to us, stands quiet in his niche, though I should forget my orisons in killing a fat buck. I stay out of my cell sometimes a night, doing by what not what. St. Dunstan never complains. A quiet master he is, and a peaceful, as ever was made of wood. But to be a yeoman in attendance on my sovereign, the king, the honour is great, doubtless, yet if I were but to step aside to comfort a widow in one corner, or to kill a deer in another, it would be, "Where is the dog priest?" says one. "Who has seen the accursed tuck?" says another. "The unfrocked villain destroys more venison than half the country besides," says one keeper, "and is hunting after every shy doe in the country," a second. "In fine, good my liege, I pray you to leave me as you found me, or if in aught you desire to extend your benevolence to me, that I may be considered as the poor clerk of St. Dunstan's cell in Copmanhurst, to whom any small donation will be most thankfully acceptable."
"I understand thee," said the king, "and the holy clerk shall have a grant of vert and venison in my woods of Warncliffe. Mark, however, I will but assign thee 3 bucks every season, but if that do not prove an apology for thy slaying 30, I am no Christian knight or true king."
"Your grace may be well assured," said the friar, "that with the grace of St. Dunstan I shall find the way of multiplying your most bounteous gift."
"I nothing doubt it, good brother," said the king, "and as venison is but dry food, our cellarer shall have orders to deliver to thee a butt of sack, a runlet of Malvoisie, and 3 hogsheads of ale of the first strike yearly. If that will not quench thy thirst, thou must come to court and become acquainted with my butler."
"But for St. Dunstan," said the friar,
"a cope, a stole, and altar cloth shalt thou also have," continued the king, crossing himself. "But we may not turn our game into earnest, lest God punish us for thinking more on our own follies than on his honour and worship."
"I will answer for my patron," said the priest joyously.
"Answer for thyself, friar," said King Richard, something sternly, but immediately stretching out his hand to the hermit. The latter, somewhat abashed, bent his knee and saluted it. "Thou dost less honour to my extended palm than to my clenched fist," said the monarch. "Thou didst only kneel to the one, and to the other didst prostrate thyself." But the friar, afraid perhaps of again giving offence by continuing the conversation in too jocose a style, a false step to be particularly guarded against by those who converse with monarchs, bowed profoundly and fell into the rear. At the same time, 2 additional personages appeared on the scene.
Chapter 11. All hail to the lordings of high degree, who live not more happy, though greater than we, our pastimes to see under every green tree in all the gay woodland, right welcome ye be. MacDonald. The newcomers were Wilfred of Ivanhoe, on the prior of St. Botolph's Palfrey, and Gurth, who attended him, on the knight's own war-horse. The astonishment of Ivanhoe was beyond bounds when he saw his master besprinkled with blood, and 6 or 7 dead bodies lying around in the little glade in which the battle had taken place. Nor was he less surprised to find Richard surrounded by so many sylvan attendants, the outlaws, as they seemed to be, of the forest, and a perilous retinue, therefore, for a prince. He hesitated whether to address the king as the Black Knight Errant, or in what other manner to demean himself towards him. Richard saw his embarrassment. "Fear not, Wilfred," he said, "to address Richard Plantagenet as himself, since thou seest him in the company of true English hearts, although it may be they have been urged a few steps aside by warm English blood." "Sir Wilfred of Ivanhoe," said the gallant outlaw, stepping forward, "my assurances can add nothing to those of our sovereign, yet let me say somewhat proudly that of men who have suffered much, he hath not truer subjects than those who now stand around him." "I cannot doubt it, brave man," said Wilfred, "since thou art of the number. But what mean these marks of death and danger, these slain men and the bloody armour of my prince?"
"Treason hath been with us, Ivanhoe," said the king, "but thanks to these brave men, treason hath met its meed. But now I bethink me, thou too art a traitor," said Richard, smiling, "a most disobedient traitor, for were not our orders positive that thou shouldst repose thyself at St. Botolph's until thy wound was healed?"
"It is healed," said Ivanhoe. "It is not of more consequence than the scratch of a bodkin. But why, oh why, noble prince, will you thus vex the hearts of thy faithful servants, and expose your life by lonely journeys and rash adventures, as if it were of no more value than that of a mere knight-errant, who has no interest on earth save what lance and sword may procure him?"
"And Richard Plantagenet," said the king, "desires no more fame than his good lance and sword may acquire him. And Richard Plantagenet is prouder of achieving an adventure with only his good sword and his good arm to speed than if he led to battle an host of 100,000 armed men."
"But your kingdom, my lord," said Ivanhoe, "your kingdom is threatened with dissolution and civil war. Your subjects menaced by every species of evil, if deprived of their sovereign in some of these dangers which it is your daily pleasure to incur, and from which you have but this moment narrowly escaped."
Oh, my kingdom and my subjects," answered Richard impatiently. "I tell thee, Sir Wilfred, the best of them are most willing to repay my follies in kind. For example, my faithful servant, Wilfred of Ivanhoe, will not obey my positive commands, and yet reads his king a homily, because he does not walk exactly conformable to his advice. Which of us has most reason to upbraid the other? Yet forgive me, my faithful Wilfred. The time I have spent, and am yet to spend in concealment, is, as I explained to thee at St. Botolph's, necessary to give my friends and faithful nobles time to assemble their forces, that when Richard's return is announced, he should be at the head of such a force as enemies shall tremble to face, and thus subdue the meditated treason without even unsheathing a sword. Estotteville and Beaune will not be strong enough to move forward to York for 24 hours. I must have news of Salisbury from the south, and of Beecham in Warwickshire, and of Multon and Percy in the north. The Chancellor must make sure of London, and I must hear the tidings. Too sudden an appearance would subject me to dangers, other than what my sword and lance, though backed by the bow of bold Robin, the quarter-staff of Friar Tuck, and the horn of the sage Wamba, may be able to rescue me from." Wilfred bowed in submission, well knowing how vain it was to contend with the wild spirit of chivalry which so often impelled his master upon dangers which he might easily have avoided, or rather which it was unpardonable in him to have sought out. Wilfred sighed, therefore, and held his peace, while Richard, rejoicing at having silenced his counsellor, though his heart acknowledged the justice of the charge he had brought against him, went on in conversation with Robin Hood.
"King of outlaws," he said, "have you no refreshment to offer to your brother sovereign? For these dead knaves have found me both in exercise and appetite."
"In troth," replied the outlaw, "for I scorn to lie to your grace, our larder is chiefly supplied with—"
He stopped and was somewhat embarrassed.
"With venison, I suppose," said Richard gaily. "Better food at need there can be none. And truly, if a king will not remain at home to slay his own game, methinks he should not brawl too loud if he find it killed to his hand."
"If your grace, then,"
said Robin, "will again honour with your presence one of Robin Hood's places of rendezvous. The venison shall not be lacking, and a stoup of ale, or it may be a cup of reasonably good wine, to relish it withal." The outlaw accordingly led the way, followed by the buxom monarch, more happy probably in this chance meeting with Robin Hood and his foresters than he would have been in again assuming his royal state and presiding over a splendid circle of peers and nobles. Novelty in society and in adventure was the zest of life to Richard Coeur de Lion, and it had its highest relish when enhanced by dangers encountered and surmounted. In the Lion-Hearted King, the brilliant but useless character of a knight of romance was in great measure realized, and the personal glory which he acquired by his own deeds of arms was far more dear to his excited imagination than that which a course of policy and wisdom would have spread around his government. Accordingly, his reign was like the course of a brilliant and rapid meteor, which shoots along the face of heaven, shedding around an unnecessary and portentous light, which is instantly swallowed up by universal darkness, his feats of chivalry furnishing themes for bards and minstrels, but affording none of those solid benefits to his country on which history loves to pause and hold up as an example to posterity. But in his present company, Richard showed to the greatest imaginable advantage. He was gay, good-humoured, liberal, and fond of manhood in every rank of life. Beneath a huge oak tree, the sylvan repast was hastily prepared for the King of England, surrounded by men late outlaws to his government, but who now formed his court and his guard. As the flagon passed round, the rough foresters soon lost their awe for the presence of majesty. The song and the jest were exchanged, the stories of former feats were told with advantage, and at length, while boasting of their successful infraction of the laws, no one recollected they were speaking in presence of their natural guardian. The merry king, nothing heeding his dignity any more than the company, laughed, quaffed, and jested amongst the jolly band. The natural and rough sense of Robin Hood led him to be desirous that the scene should be closed ere something should occur to disturb its harmony, the more especially that he observed Ivanhoe's brow clouded with anxiety. "We are honoured," he said to the baron apart, "by the presence of our gallant sovereign, yet I would not that he dallied with time, which the circumstances of his kingdom may render precious." "It is well and wisely spoken, brave Robin Hood," said the knight, "and know, moreover, that they who jest with majesty, even in its gayest mood, are but toying with the lion's whelp, which on slight provocation uses both fangs and claws." "You have touched the very cause of my fear," said the outlaw. "My men are rough by practice and nature. The king is hasty as well as good-humoured, nor know I how soon cause of offence may arise, or how warmly it may be received. It is time this revel were broken off." "It must be by your management, then, gallant yeoman," said Ivanhoe, "for each hint I have essayed to give him serves only to induce him to prolong it."
"Must I so soon risk the pardon and favour of my sovereign?" said Robin Hood, pausing for an instant. "But by St. Christopher it shall be so. I were undeserving his grace did I not peril it for his good. Here, Scathlock, get thee behind yonder thicket, and wind me a Norman blast on thy bugle, and without an instant's delay, on peril of your life."
Scathlock obeyed his captain, and in less than 5 minutes the revellers were startled by the sound of his horn.
"It is the bugle of Malvoisin,"
said the miller, starting to his feet and seizing his bow. The friar dropped the flagon and grasped his quarterstaff. Wamba stopped short in the midst of a jest and betook himself to sword and target. All the others stood to their weapons. Men of their precarious course of life change readily from the banquet to the battle, and to Richard the exchange seemed but a succession of pleasure. He called for his helmet and the most cumbrous parts of his armour, which he had laid aside, and while Girth was putting them on, he laid his strict injunctions on Wilfred, under pain of his highest displeasure, not to engage in the skirmish which he supposed was approaching.
"Thou hast fought for me 100 times, Wilfred, and I have seen it. Thou shalt this day look on and see how Richard will fight for his friend and liegeman."
In the meanwhile,
Robin Hood had sent off several of his followers in different directions, as if to reconnoitre the enemy, and when he saw the company effectually broken up, he approached Richard, who was now completely armed, and, kneeling down on one knee, craved pardon of his sovereign.
"For what, good yeoman?"
said Richard, somewhat impatiently. "Have we not already granted thee a full pardon for all transgressions? Thinkest thou our word is a feather to be blown backward and forward betwixt us? Thou canst not have had time to commit any new offence since that time." "Aye, but I have, though," answered the outlaw, "if it be an offence to deceive my prince for his own advantage. The bugle you have heard was none of Malvoisin's, but was blown by my direction, to break off our banquet, lest it trenched upon hours of dearer import than to be thus dallied with." He then rose from his knee, folded his arms on his bosom, and, in a manner rather respectful than submissive, awaited the answer of the king, like one who is conscious he may have given offence, yet is confident in the rectitude of his motive. The blood rushed in anger to the countenance of Richard, but it was the first transient emotion, and his sense of justice instantly subdued it. "The King of Sherwood," he said, "grudges his venison and his wine flask to the King of England. It is well, bold Robin. But when you come to see me in merry London, I trust to be a less niggard host." "Thou art right, however, good fellow. Let us therefore to horse and away. Wilfred has been impatient this hour. Tell me, bold Robin, hast thou never a friend in thy band who, not content with advising, will needs direct thy motions and look miserable when thou dost presume to act for thyself?" "Such a one," said Robin, "is my lieutenant, Little John, who is even now absent on an expedition as far as the borders of Scotland, and I will own to your majesty that I am sometimes displeased by the freedom of his counsels, but when I think twice, I cannot be long angry with one who can have no motive for his anxiety save zeal for his master's service." "Thou art right, good yeoman," answered Richard. "And if I had Ivanhoe on the one hand to give grave advice, and recommend it by the sad gravity of his brow, and thee, on the other, to trick me into what thou thinkest my own good, I should have as little the freedom of my own will as any king in Christendom or heathenness. But come, sirs, let us merrily on to Coningsborough, and think no more on't." Robin Hood assured them that he had detached a party in the direction of the road they were to pass, who would not fail to discover and apprise them of any second ambuscade, and that he had little doubt they would find the ways secure, or if otherwise would receive such timely notice of the danger as might enable them to fall back upon a strong troop of archers, with which he himself proposed to follow on the same route. The wise and attentive precautions adopted for his safety touched Richard's feelings, and removed any slight grudge he might retain on account of the deception which the outlaw captain had practised upon him. He once more extended his hand to Robin Hood, assured him of his full pardon and future favour, as well as his firm resolution to restrain the tyrannical exercise of the forest rights and other oppressive laws by which so many English yeomen were driven into a state of rebellion. But Richard's good intentions towards the bold outlaw were frustrated by the king's untimely death, and the charter of the forest was extorted from the unwilling hands of King John when he succeeded to his heroic brother. As for the rest of Robin Hood's career, as well as the tale of his treacherous death, they are to be found in those black-letter garlands once sold at the low and easy rate of 1 halfpenny, now cheaply purchased at their weight in gold. The outlaw's opinion proved true, and the king, attended by Ivanhoe, Gurth, and Wamba, arrived without any interruption within view of the castle of Coningsborough while the sun was yet in the horizon. There are few more beautiful or striking scenes in England than are presented by the vicinity of this ancient Saxon fortress. The soft and gentle River Don sweeps through an amphitheatre in which cultivation is richly blended with woodland, and on a mount, ascending from the river, well defended by walls and ditches, rises this ancient edifice, which, as its Saxon name implies, was, previous to the conquest, a royal residence of the kings of England. The outer walls have probably been added by the Normans, but the inner keep bears token of very great antiquity. It is situated on a mount at one angle of the inner court, and forms a complete circle of perhaps 25 feet in diameter. The wall is of immense thickness, and is propped or defended by 6 huge external buttresses, which project from the circle and rise up against the sides of the tower as if to strengthen or support it. These massive buttresses are hollowed out towards the top and terminate in a sort of turrets communicating with the interior of the keep itself. The distant appearance of this huge building, with these singular accompaniments, is as interesting to the lovers of the picturesque as the interior of the castle is to the eager antiquary, whose imagination it carries back to the days of the Heptarchy. A barrow, in the vicinity of the castle, is pointed out as the tomb of the memorable Hengist, and various monuments of great antiquity and curiosity are shown in the neighbouring churchyard. When Coeur de Lion and his retinue approached this rude yet stately building, it was not, as at present, surrounded by external fortifications. The Saxon architect had exhausted his art in rendering the main keep defensible, and there was no other circumvallation than a rude barrier of palisades. A huge black banner, which floated from the top of the tower, announced that the obsequies of its late owner were still in the act of being solemnized. It bore no emblem of the deceased's birth or quality, for armorial bearings were then a novelty among the Norman chivalry themselves and were totally unknown to the Saxons. But above the gate was another banner, on which the figure of a white horse, rudely painted, indicated the nation and rank of the deceased by the well-known symbol of Hengist and his warriors. All around the castle was a scene of busy commotion, for such funeral banquets were a time of general and profuse hospitality, which not only everyone who could claim the most distant connection with the deceased, but all passengers whatsoever were invited to partake. The wealth and consequence of the deceased Athelstane occasioned this custom to be observed in the fullest extent. Numerous parties, therefore, were seen ascending and descending the hill on which the castle was situated, and when the king and his attendants entered the open and unguarded gates of the external barrier, the space within presented a scene not easily reconciled with the cause of the assemblage. In one place, cooks were toiling to roast huge oxen and fat sheep. In another, hogsheads of ale were set abroach to be drained at the freedom of all comers. Groups of every description were to be seen devouring the food and swilling the liquor, thus abandoned to their discretion. The half-naked Saxon serf was drowning the sense of his half-year's hunger and thirst in one day's gluttony and drunkenness. The more pampered burgess and guild brother was eating his morsel with gust, or curiously criticizing the quality of the malt and the skill of the brewer. Some few of the poorer Norman gentry might also be seen, distinguished by their shaven chins and short cloaks, and not less so by their keeping together and looking with great scorn on the whole solemnity, even while condescending to avail themselves of the good cheer which was so liberally supplied. Mendicants were, of course, assembled by the score, together with strolling soldiers returned from Palestine, according to their own account at least. Peddlers were displaying their wares, travelling mechanics were inquiring after employment, and wandering palmers, hedge priests, Saxon minstrels, and Welsh bards were muttering prayers and extracting mistuned dirges from their harps, crowds, and rotes. One sent forth the praises of Athelstane in a doleful panegyric. Another, in a Saxon genealogical poem, rehearsed the uncouth and harsh names of his noble ancestry. Jesters and jugglers were not wanting, nor was the solemnity of the occasion supposed to render the exercise of their profession indecorous or improper. Indeed, the ideas of the Saxons on such occasions were as natural as they were rude. If sorrow was thirsty, there was drink. If hungry, there was food. If it sunk down upon and saddened the heart, there were the means supplied of mirth, or at least of amusement. Nor did the assistants scorn to avail themselves of those means of consolation, although every now and then, as if suddenly recollecting the cause which had brought them together, the men groaned in unison, while the females, of whom many were present, raised up their voices and shrieked for very woe. Such was the scene in the castle yard at Coningsborough when it was entered by Richard and his followers. The seneschal or steward, who deigned not to take notice of the groups of inferior guests who were perpetually entering and withdrawing, unless so far as was necessary to preserve order, was struck with the good mien of the monarch and Ivanhoe, more especially as he imagined the features of the latter were familiar to him. Besides, the approach of two knights, for such their dress bespoke them, was a rare event at a Saxon solemnity, and could not but be regarded as a sort of honour to the deceased and his family. And in his sable dress, and holding in his hand his white wand of office, this important personage made way through the miscellaneous assemblage of guests, thus conducting Richard and Ivanhoe to the entrance of the tower. Girth and Wamba speedily found acquaintances in the courtyard, nor presumed to intrude themselves any farther until their presence was required. Chapter 12 I found them winding of Marcello's corpse, and there was such a solemn melody, twixt doleful songs, tears, and sad elegies, such as old granddames watching by the dead are wont to outwear the night with. Old play. The mode of entering the great tower of Coningsborough Castle is very peculiar, and partakes of the rude simplicity of the early times in which it was erected. A flight of steps, so deep and narrow as to be almost precipitous, leads up to a low portal on the south side of the tower, by which the adventurous antiquary may still, or at least could a few years since, gain access to a small stair within the thickness of the main wall of the tower, which leads up to the third story of the building, the two lower being dungeons or vaults, which neither receive air nor light, save by a square hole in the third story, with which they seem to have communicated by a ladder. The access to the upper apartments in the tower, which consists in all of five stories, is given by stairs which are carried up through the external buttresses. By this difficult and complicated entrance, the good King Richard, followed by his faithful Ivanhoe, was ushered into the round apartment which occupies the whole of the third story from the ground. The latter had time to muffle his face in his mantle, as it had been held expedient that he should not present himself to his father until the king should give him the signal. There were assembled in this apartment, around a large oaken table, about a dozen of the most distinguished representatives of Saxon families in the adjacent country. These were all old, or at least elderly, men, for the younger race, to the great disquiet of the seniors, had, like Ivanhoe, broken down many of the barriers which had separated for half a century the Norman victors from the vanquished Saxons. The downcast and sorrowful looks of these venerable men, their silence and their mournful posture, formed a strong contrast to the levity of the revellers on the outside of the castle. Their grey locks and long, full beards, together with their antique tunics and loose black mantles, suited well with the singular and rude apartment in which they were seated, and gave the appearance of a band of the ancient worshippers of Woden, recalled to life to mourn over the decay of their national glory. Cedric, seated in equal rank among his countrymen, seemed yet, by common consent, to act as chief of the assembly. Upon the entrance of Richard, only known to him as the valorous Knight of the Fetterlock, he arose gravely and gave him welcome by the ordinary salutation, "Wais hail," raising at the same time a goblet to his head. The king, no stranger to the customs of his English subjects, returned the greeting with the appropriate words, "Drink hail," and partook of a cup which was handed to him by the sewer. The same courtesy was offered to Ivanhoe, who pledged his father in silence, supplying the usual speech by an inclination of his head, lest his voice should have been recognized. When this introductory ceremony was performed, Cedric arose, and extending his hand to Richard, conducted him into a small and very rude chapel, which was excavated, as it were, out of one of the external buttresses. As there was no opening, saving a very narrow loophole, the place would have been nearly quite dark but for two flambeaux or torches, which showed, by a red and smoky light, the arched roof and naked walls, the rude altar of stone, and the crucifix of the same materials. Before this altar was placed a bier, and on each side of the bier kneeled three priests, who told their beads and muttered their prayers with the greatest signs of external devotion. For this service a splendid soul scat was paid to the convent of St. Edmund by the mother of the deceased, and that it might be fully deserved, the whole brethren, saving the lame sacristan, had transferred themselves to Coningsboro, where, while six of their number, relieved from time to time by their brethren, were constantly engaged in the performance of divine rites beside the bier of Athelstane, the others failed not to take their share of the refreshments and amusements which went on in the castle. In maintaining this pious watch and ward, the good monks were particularly careful not to interrupt their hymns for an instant, lest Zernebock, the ancient Saxon Apollyon, should lay his clutches on the departed Athelstane. Nor were they less careful to prevent any unhallowed layman from touching the pall, which, having been that used at the funeral of St. Edmund, was liable to be desecrated if handled by profane hands. If, in truth, these attentions could be of any use to the deceased, he had some right to expect them at the hands of the brethren of St. Edmund's, since, besides 100 mancuses of gold paid down as the sole ransom, the mother of Athelstane had announced her intention of endowing that foundation with the better part of the lands of the deceased, in order to maintain perpetual prayers for his soul and that of her departed husband. Richard and Wilfred followed the Saxon Cedric into this apartment of death, where, as their guide pointed with a solemn air to the untimely bier of Athelstane, they followed his example in devoutly crossing themselves and muttering a brief prayer for the weal of the departed soul. This act of pious charity performed, Cedric again motioned them to follow him. Gliding over the stone floor with a noiseless tread, and after ascending a few steps, he opened with great caution the door of a small oratory, which adjoined to the chapel. It was about 8 feet square, hollowed, like the chapel itself, out of the thickness of the wall, but the loophole which enlightened it, being to the west, and widening considerably as it sloped inward, a beam of the setting sun found its way into its dark recess, and showed a female of a dignified mien, and whose countenance retained the marked remains of majestic beauty. Her long mourning robes and her flowing wimple of black cypress enhanced the whiteness of her skin and the beauty of her light-coloured and flowing tresses, which time had neither thinned nor mingled with silver. Her countenance expressed the deepest sorrow that is consistent with resignation. On the stone table before her stood a crucifix of ivory, beside which was laid a missal, having its pages richly illuminated, and its boards adorned with clasps of gold and bosses of the same precious metal. "Noble Edith," said Cedric, after having stood a minute silent, as if to give Richard and Wilfred time to look upon the lady of the manor, "these are worthy strangers, come to take a part in thy sorrows, and this, in especial, is the valiant knight who fought so bravely for the deliverance of him for whom we this day mourn."
"His bravery hath my thanks," returned the lady, "although it be the will of heaven that it should be displayed in vain. I thank too his courtesy and that of his companion, which hath brought them hither to behold the widow of Adeling, the mother of Athelstane, in her deep hour of sorrow and lamentation. To your care, kind kinsman, I entrust them, satisfied that they will want no hospitality, which these sad walls can yet afford."
The guests bowed deeply to the mourning parent, and withdrew with their hospitable guide. Another winding stair conducted them to an apartment of the same size with that they had first entered, occupying indeed the story immediately above. From this room, yet the door was opened, proceeded a low and melancholy strain of vocal music. When they entered, they found themselves in presence of about 20 matrons and maidens of distinguished Saxon lineage. Four maidens, Rowena leading the choir, raised a hymn for the soul of the deceased, of which we have only been able to decipher two or three stanzas. "Dust unto dust, to this all must. The tenant hath resigned the faded form to waste and worm. Corruption claims her kind. Through paths unknown thy soul hath flown to seek the realms of woe, where fiery pain shall purge the stain of actions done below. In that sad place, by Mary's grace, brief may thy dwelling be, till prayers and alms and holy psalms shall set the captive free. While this dirge was sung in a low and melancholy tone by the female choristers, the others were divided into two bands, of which one was engaged in bedecking, with such embroidery as their skill and taste could compass, a large silken pall destined to cover the bier of Athelstane, whilst the others busied themselves in selecting, from baskets of flowers placed before them, garlands, which they destined for the same mournful purpose. The behaviour of the maidens was decorous, if not marked with deep affliction, but now and then a whisper or a smile called forth the rebuke of the severer matrons, and here and there might be seen a damsel apparently more interested in endeavouring to find out how her mourning robe became her than in the dismal ceremony for which they were preparing. Neither was this propensity, if we must needs confess the truth, at all diminished by the appearance of two stranger knights, which occasioned some looking up, peeping, and whispering. Rowena alone, too proud to be vain, paid her greeting to her deliverer with graceful courtesy. Her demeanour was serious, but not dejected, and it may be doubted whether thoughts of Ivanhoe and of the uncertainty of his fate did not claim as great a share in her gravity as the death of her kinsman. To Cedric, however, who, as we have observed, was not remarkably clear-sighted on such occasions, the sorrows of his ward seemed so much deeper than any of the other maidens that he deemed it proper to whisper the explanation.
She was the affianced bride of the noble Athelstane.
It may be doubted whether this communication went a far way to increase Wilfred's disposition to sympathize with the mourners of Coningsboro. Having thus formally introduced the guests to the various chambers in which the obsequies of Athelstane were celebrated under different forms, Cedric conducted them into a small room, destined, as he informed them, for the exclusive accommodation of honourable guests, whose more slight connection with the deceased might render them unwilling to join those who were immediately affected by the unhappy event. He assured them of every accommodation, and was about to withdraw, when the Black Knight took his hand. "I crave to remind you, noble Thane," he said, "that when we last parted you promised, for the service which I had the fortune to render you, to grant me a boon."
"It is granted ere named, noble knight," said Cedric.
"Yet at this sad moment—" "Of that also," said the king, "I have bethought me. But my time is brief. Neither does it seem to me unfit that, when closing the grave on the noble Athelstane, we should deposit therein certain prejudices and hasty opinions." "Sir Knight of the Fetterlock," said Cedric, colouring and interrupting the king in his turn, "I trust your boon regards yourself and no other, for in that which concerns the honour of my house, it is scarce fitting that a stranger should mingle." "Nor do I wish to mingle," said the king mildly, "unless in so far as you will admit me to have an interest. As yet you have known me but as the Black Knight of the Fetterlock. Know me now as Richard Plantagenet."
"Richard of Anjou?" exclaimed Cedric, stepping backward with the utmost astonishment.
"No, noble Cedric, Richard of England, whose dearest interest, whose deepest wish it is to see her sons united with each other.
And how now, worthy Thane? Hast thou no knee for thy prince?" "To Norman blood," said Cedric, "it hath never bended."
"Reserve thine homage, then," said the monarch, "until I shall prove my right to it by my equal protection of both Normans and English."
"Prince," answered Cedric, "I have ever done justice to thy bravery and thy worth.
nor am I ignorant of thy claim to the crown through thy descent from Matilda, niece to Edgar Atheling, and daughter to Malcolm of Scotland. But Matilda, though of the royal Saxon blood, was not the heir to the monarchy. I will not dispute my title with thee, noble thane, but I will bid thee look around and see where thou wilt find another which can be put into the scale against it. And hast thou ventured hither, prince, to tell me so? Said Cedric. To upbraid me with the ruin of my race, ere the grave closed on the last scion of Saxon royalty? His countenance darkened as he spoke. It was boldly, it was rashly done. Not so by the holy rood, replied the king. It was done in the frank confidence which one brave man may repose in another, without a shadow of danger. Thou sayest well, Sir King, for king I own thou art, and wilt be, despite of my feeble opposition. I dare not take the only mode to prevent it, though thou hast placed the strong temptation within my reach. And now to my boon, said the king, which I ask not with one jot the less confidence that thou hast refused to acknowledge my lawful sovereignty. I require of thee, as a man of thy word, and on pain of being held faithless, man-sworn, and niddering, to forgive and receive to thy paternal affection the good knight Wilfred of Ivanhoe. In this reconciliation thou wilt own I have an interest, the happiness of my friend, and the quelling of dissension among my faithful people. And this is Wilfred, said the Saxon, pointing to his son. My father, said Ivanhoe, prostrating himself at Cedric's feet. Grant me thy forgiveness. Thou hast it, my son, said Cedric, raising him. The son of Hereward knows how to keep his word, even when it has been passed to a Norman. But let me see thee use the dress and customs of thy English ancestry. No short cloaks, no gay tunics, no fantastic plumage in my decent household. He that would be the son of Cedric must show himself of English ancestry. Thou art about to speak, he added sternly, and I guess the topic. The Lady Rowena must complete 2 years of mourning, as for a betrothed husband. All our Saxon ancestors would disown us were we to knit a new union for her, ere the grave of him whom she should have wedded, him so much more worthy of her hand by birth and ancestry, is yet closed. The ghost of Athelstane himself would burst his bloody cerements and stand before us to forbid such dishonour to his memory. It seemed as if Cedric's words had raised a spectre, for scarce had he uttered them ere the door flew open, and Athelstane, arrayed in the garments of the grave, stood before them, pale, haggard, and like something arisen from the dead. The effect of this apparition on the persons present was utterly appalling. Cedric started back as far as the wall of the apartment would permit, and leaning against it as one unable to support himself, gazed on the figure of his friend with eyes that seemed fixed, and a mouth which he appeared incapable of shutting. Ivanhoe crossed himself, repeating prayers in Saxon, Latin, and Norman French as they occurred to his memory, while Richard alternately said Benedicite and swore Morte ma vie. In the meantime, a horrible noise was heard below stairs, some crying, Secure the treacherous monks! Others, Down with them into the lowest dungeon! Others, Pitch them from the highest battlements! In the name of God, said Cedric, addressing what seemed the spectre of his departed friend, If thou art mortal, speak! If a departed spirit, say for what cause thou dost revisit these towers, or if I may do aught that can set thy spirit at repose! Living or dead, noble Athelstane, speak to Cedric!
I will, said the spectre very composedly, when I have collected breath, and when you give me time.
Alive, saidst thou? I am as much alive as he can be who has fed on bread and water for 3 days, which seem 3 ages. Yes, bread and water, Father Cedric. By heaven and all saints in it, better food hath not passed my weasand for 3 livelong days,
and by God's providence it is that I am now here to tell it.
Why, noble Athelstane, said the Black Knight, I myself saw you struck down by the fierce Templar towards the end of the storm at Torquilstone, and, as I thought, and Wamba reported, your skull was cloven to the teeth.
You thought amiss, Sir Knight, said Athelstane, and Wamba lied. My teeth are in good order, and that my supper shall presently find. No thanks to the Templar, though, whose sword turned in his hand so that the blade struck me flatlings. Had my steel cap been on, I had not valued it a rush, and had dealt him such a counterbuff as would have spoilt his retreat. But as it was, down I went, stunned indeed, but unwounded. Others of both sides were beaten down and slaughtered above me, so that I never recovered my senses until I found myself in a coffin, an open one by good luck, placed before the high altar of the Church of St. Edmund's. I sneezed repeatedly, groaned, awakened, and would have arisen when the sacristan and abbot, full of terror, came running at the noise, surprised, doubtless, and no way pleased to find the man alive whose heirs they had proposed themselves to be. I asked for wine. They gave me some, but it must have been highly medicated, for I slept yet more deeply than before, and wakened not for many hours. I found my arms swathed down, my feet tied so fast that mine ankles ache at the very remembrance. The place was utterly dark. The oubliette, as I suppose, of their accursed convent. And from the close, stifled, damp smell, I conceive it is also used as a place of sepulture. I had strange thoughts of what had befallen me when the door of my dungeon creaked and two villain monks entered. They would have persuaded me I was in purgatory, but I knew too well the pursy, short-breath voice of the Father Abbot. Saint Jeremy, how different from that tone with which he used to ask me for another slice of the haunch. The dog has feasted with me from Christmas to Twelfth Night. Have patience, noble Athelstane, said the king. Take breath. Tell your story at leisure. Beshrew me, but such a tale is as well worth listening to as a romance. Aye, but by the rood of Broomholm, there was no romance in the matter. A barley loaf and a pitcher of water, that they gave me, the niggardly villains, whom my father and myself had enriched, when their best resources were the flitches of bacon and measures of corn, out of which they wheedled poor serfs and bondsmen in exchange for their prayers. The nest of foul, ungrateful vipers, barley, bread, and ditch-water to such a patron as I had been. I will smoke them out of their nest, though I be excommunicated. But in the name of Our Lady, noble Athelstane, said Cedric, grasping the hand of his friend, how didst thou escape this imminent danger? Did their hearts relent?
Did their hearts relent? Echoed Athelstane. Do rocks melt with a sun? I should have been there still, had not some stir in the convent, which I find was their procession hitherward to eat my funeral feast, when they well knew how and where I had been buried alive, summoned the swarm out of their hive. I heard them droning out their death psalms, little judging they were sung in respect for my soul by those who were thus punishing my body. They went, however, and I waited long for food. No wonder the gouty sacristan was even too busy with his own provender to mind mine. At length he came down, with an unstable step and a strong flavour of wine and spices about his person. Good cheer had opened his heart, for he left me a nook of pasty and a flask of wine instead of my former fare. I eat, drank, and was invigorated, when, to add to my good luck, the sacristan, too totty to discharge his duty of turnkey fitly, locked the door beside the staple so that it fell ajar. The light, the food, the wine set my invention to work. The staple to which my chains were fixed was more rusted than I or the villain abbot had supposed. Even iron could not stand without consuming in the damps of that infernal dungeon. Take breath, noble Athelstane, said Richard, and partake of some refreshment, ere you proceed with a tale so dreadful.
Partake, quoth Athelstane, I have been partaking five times a day, and yet a morsel of that savoury ham were not altogether foreign to the matter, and I pray you, fair sir, to do me reason in a cup of wine.
The guests,
though still agape with astonishment, pledged their resuscitated landlord, who thus proceeded in his story. He had indeed now many more auditors than those to whom it was commenced, for Edith, having given certain necessary orders for arranging matters within the castle, had followed the dead alive up to the stranger's apartment, attended by as many of the guests, male and female, as could squeeze into the small room, while others, crowding the staircase, caught up an erroneous edition of the story, and transmitted it still more inaccurately to those beneath, who again sent it forth to the vulgar without, in a fashion totally irreconcilable to the real fact. Athelstane, however, went on as follows with the history of his escape.
Finding myself freed from the staple, I dragged myself upstairs as well as a man loaded with shackles and emaciated with fasting might, and after much groping about, I was at length directed, by the sound of a jolly roundelay, to the apartment where the worthy sacristan, an it please you, was holding a devil's mass with a huge, beetle-browed, broad-shouldered brother of the grey frock and cord, who looked much more like a thief than a clergyman. I burst in upon them, and the fashion of my grave clothes, as well as the clanking of my chains, made me more resemble an inhabitant of the other world than of this. Both stood aghast. But when I knocked down the sacristan with my fist, the other fella, his pot companion, fetched a blow at me with a huge quarterstaff.
"This must be our Friar Tuck for a count's ransom," said Richard, looking at Ivanhoe.
"He may be the devil, and he will," said Athelstane. "Fortunately, he missed his aim, and on my approaching to grapple with them, took to his heels and ran for it. I failed not to set my own heels at liberty by means of the fetter key which hung amongst others at the sexton's belt, and I had thoughts of beating out the knave's brains with the bunch of keys, but the thoughts of the nook of pasty and the flask of wine which the rascal had imparted to my captivity came over my heart. So, with a brace of hearty kicks, I left him on the floor, pouched some baked meat and a leathern bottle of wine, with which the two venerable brethren had been regaling, went to the stable and found in a private stall mine own best palfrey, which doubtless had been set apart for the holy Father Abbot's particular use. Hither I came with all the speed the beast could compass, man and mother's son flying before me wherever I came, taking me for a spectre, the more especially as, to prevent my being recognised, I drew the corpse hood over my face. I had not gained admittance into my own castle, had I not been supposed to be the attendant of a juggler, who was making the people in the castle yard very merry, considering they're assembled to celebrate their lord's funeral. I say the sewer thought I was dressed to bear a part in the treasurer's mummery, and so I got admission, and did but disclose myself to my mother, and eat a hasty morsel, ere I came in quest of you, my noble friend. "And you have found me," said Cedric, "ready to resume our brave projects of honour and liberty. I tell thee, never will dawn a morrow so auspicious as the next, for the deliverance of the noble Saxon race."
"Talk not to me of delivering anyone," said Athelstane. "It is well I am delivered myself. I am more intent on punishing that villain abbot. He shall hang on the top of this castle of Coningsborough in his cope and stole, and if the stairs be too straight to admit his fat carcass, I will have him craned up from without."
"But, my son," said Edith, "consider his sacred office."
"Consider my 3 days fast," replied Athelstane. "I will have their blood, every man of them. Front de Boeuf was burned alive for a less matter, for he kept a goodly table for his prisoners, only put too much garlic in his last dish of pottage. But these hypocritical, ungrateful slaves, so often the self-invited flatterers at my board, who gave me neither pottage nor garlic, more or less, they die by the soul of Hengist."
"But the Pope, my noble friend," said Cedric.
"But the devil, my noble friend," answered Athelstane. "They die, and no more of them. Were they the last monks upon earth, the world would go on without them."
"For shame, noble Athelstane," said Cedric.
Forget such wretches and the career of glory which lies open before thee. Tell this Norman prince, Richard of Anjou, that, lion-hearted as he is, he shall not hold undisputed the throne of Alfred while a male descendant of the Holy Confessor lives to dispute it.
How? Said Athelstane. Is this the noble King Richard?
It is Richard Plantagenet himself, replied Cedric. Yet I need not remind thee that, coming hither a guest of free will, he may neither be injured nor detained prisoner. Thou well knowest thy duty to him as his host.